twilight was fast approaching when I emerged from the bathroom, redolent of rare aromas, pink and svelte. But the real battle had not yet begun. Laid out on my bed was my beautiful summer formal. Al was right. The elegant white coat truly gleamed in virginal splendor. Not a trace of the red stain or the sinister hole could be detected. The coat was ready for another night of celebration, its lapels spotless, its sleeves smooth and uncreased. Carefully, I undid the pins that festooned my pleated Monte Carlo shirt. It was the damnedest thing I'd ever seen. Once I got it straightened out, long, trailing, gauze-like shirt tails, a crinkly front that thrummed like sheet metal, and a collar that seemed to be carved out of white rock. I slipped it on. Panic! It had no buttons, just holes. Rummaging around frantically in the box the suit came in, I found the cellophane envelope containing little round black things. Ripping the envelope open, I poured them out. There were five of them, two of which immediately darted under the bed. From the looks of the remaining three, they certainly weren't buttons, but they'd have to do. Although I didn't know it at the time, I had observed a classic maneuver executed by at least one stud out of every set rented with a tux. Down on my hands and knees, already beginning to lose my lifebuoy sheen, sweat popping out here and there, I scrambled around for the missing studs. The adolescent torture ordeal was well underway, although I did not know it at the time. 7 o'clock was approaching with such rapidity as to be almost unbelievable. Schwartz, Clara May, and Wanda would already be waiting for me, and here I was, in my underwear, crawling around on my hands and knees. Finally, amid the dust and dead spiders under my bed, I found the two studs, cowering together behind a hardball I'd lost 3 months earlier. Back before the mirror again, I struggled to get them in place between the concrete slits of the shirt. Sweat was beginning to show under my arms. I got two in over my breastbone, and now I tried to get the one at the collar over my Adam's apple. No way! It was impossible! I could feel from deep within me several sobs beginning to form. The more I struggled, the more ham-fisted I became. Oh, no, no, two black thumb smudges appeared on the snow-white collar. Ma! I screamed. Look at my shirt! She rushed in from the kitchen, carrying a paring knife and a pan of apples. What's the matter? Look! I pointed at the telltale prints. My kid brother cackled in delight when he saw the trouble I was in. Don't touch it, she barked, taking control immediately. Dirty collars were her métier. She had fought them all her life. She darted out of the room and returned instantly with an art gum eraser. Now, hold still. I obeyed as she carefully worked the stud in place and then artistically erased the two monstrous thumbprints. Never in my life had I experienced a collar remotely like the one that now clamped its iron grasp around my windpipe. Hard and unyielding, made of concrete, it dug mercilessly into my throat. A mere sample of what was to come. "Where's your tie?" she asked. I had forgotten about that detail. It must be in the box, I managed to gasp out. The collar had almost paralyzed my voice box. She rummaged around and came up with the bow tie. It was black and had two metal clips. She snapped it onto the wing collar and stood back. "Now, look at yourself in the mirror." I didn't recognize myself. She picked up the midnight blue trousers and held them up so that I could slip into them without bending over. True to his word, Al had indeed taken in the seat. The pants now clamped me in a vice-like grip that was to damn near emasculate me before the evening was out. I sucked in my stomach, buttoned the waistband tight, zippered up the fly, and stood straight as a ramrod. It was the only way I could stand before the mirror. I had no other choice. "Give me your foot." My mother was down on all fours, pulling the silky black socks onto my feet. Then, out of a box on the bed, she removed the gleaming pair of patent leather dancing pumps, grabbed my right foot, and shoved it into one of them, using her finger as a shoehorn. I tromped down. She yelled in pain. "I can't get my finger out!" I hobbled around, taking her finger with me. "Stand still!" she screamed. I stood like a crane, one foot in the air, with her finger jammed deep into the heel. "Randy, come here! Brandy!" she yelled. My kid brother, who was sulking under the daybed, ran into the room. "Pull his shoe off, Randy, now!" She was frantic. "What for?" he asked sullenly. "What do you mean, what for? Don't ask stupid questions. Do what I say!" I was getting an enormous cramp now in my right buttock. "Stand still," she yelled. "You're breaking my finger." The pain roared up and down my back. Randy looked on impassively, observing a scene that he was later to weave into a family legend, embroidering it more and more as the years went by, making himself the hero, of course. "Randy, take off the shoe!" Her voice quavered with pain and exasperation. He squirted my T-shirt. "If you don't take off his shoe this instant, you're going to regret it." This time her voice was low and menacing. We both knew the tone. It was the end of the line. Randy bent over and tugged at the shoe. My mother toppled over backward in relief, rubbing her index finger, which was already getting blue. "Go back under the daybed," she snapped. He scurried out of the room. I straightened out my leg, the cramp subsiding like a volcano in the marrow of my bones, and the gleaming pumps were put in place without further incident. I now stood, encased as in armor. "What's this thing?" she asked from behind me. I executed a careful 180-degree turn. "Oh, Al says that's a cummerbund." Her face lit up like an Italian sunrise. "A cummerbund!" She had seen Fred Astaire in many a cummerbund while he spun down marble staircases with Ginger Rogers in his arms. But it was the first actual specimen she had ever been close to. She picked it up reverently, its paisley brilliance lighting up the room like an iridescent jewel. "How does it work?" she asked, examining it closely. Before I could answer, she said, "Oh, I see. It has clips in the back. Hold still." Around my waist it went. She drew it tight. The snaps clicked into place. It rode snugly halfway up my chest. She picked up the snowy coat and held it out. I lowered my arms into it and straightened up. She darted around to the front, closed the single button, and there I stood. Adonis. Posing before the full-length mirror on the bathroom door, I noted the rich accent of my velvet stripes, the gleam of my pumps, the magnificent dash and sparkle of my high-fashion Hollywood cummerbund. What a sight! What a feeling! This is the way life should be. This is what it's all about. I heard my mother call out from the next room. "Hey, what's this thing?" She came out holding a cellophane bag containing a maroon object. "Oh, that's my boutonniere." "Your what?" "It's a thing for the lapel, like a fake flower." It was the work of an instant to install my elegant wool carnation. It was the crowning touch. I was so overwhelmed that I didn't care about the fact that it didn't match my black tie, as Al had promised. With the cummerbund I was wearing, no one would notice anyway. I was fantastic. Taking my leave as Cary Grant would have done, I sauntered out the front door, turning to give my mother a jaunty wave, just in time for her to call me back to pick up Wanda's corsage, which I had left on the front hall table. Slipping carefully into the front seat of my Ford, with the cellophane top box safely beside me, I leaned forward slightly to avoid wrinkling the back of my coat, started the motor up. Oh, and I shoved off into the warm summer night. A soft June moon hung overhead. The Ford purred like a kitten. When I pulled up before Wanda's house, it was lit up from top to bottom. Even before my brakes had stopped squealing, she was out on the porch, her mother fluttering about her, her father lurking in the background, beaming. With stately, magnificent tread, I moved up the walk. My pants were so tight that if I had taken one false step, God knows what would have happened. In my sweaty, aqua-velva-scented palm, I clutched the ritual largesse in its shiny cellophane box. Wanda wore a long turquoise taffeta gown, her milky skin and golden hair radiating in the glow of the porch light. This was not the old Wanda. For one thing, she didn't have her glasses on, and her eyes were unnaturally large and liquid, the way the true myopia victims always are. "Gee, thanks for the orchid," she whispered. Her voice sounded strained. In accordance with the tribal custom, she too being mercilessly clamped by straps and girdles. Her mother, an almost exact copy of Wanda, only slightly puffy here and there, said, "You'll take care of her now, won't you?" "Now, Emily, don't start yapping," her old man muttered in the darkness. "They're not kids anymore." They stood in the door as we drove off through the soft night towards Schwartz's house. Our conversation stilted, our excitement almost at the boiling point. Schwartz rushed out of his house, his white coat like a ghost in the darkness, his hair agleam with Brill Cream, and surrounded by a palpable aura of Lifebuoy. 5 minutes later, Clara May piled into the back seat beside him, carefully holding up her daffodil yellow skirts, her long, slender neck arched. She, too, wasn't wearing her glasses. I'd never realized that a good speller could be pretty. Schwartz, a good half a head shorter, laughed nervously as we tooled on towards the Sherrywood Country Club. From all over town, other cars, polished and waxed, carried the rest of our junior class to their great trial by fire. The club nestled amid the rolling hills, where the Sinclair oil refinery aroma was only barely detectable. Parking the car in the lot, we threaded our way through the starched crowd, the girls' girdles creaking in unison, to the grand ballroom. Japanese lanterns danced in the breeze through the open doors of the garden, bathing the dance floor in a fairy tale glow. I found myself saying things like, "Why, hello there, Albert, how are you?" And, "Yes, I believe the weather is perfect indeed." Only Flick, the unregenerate Philistine, failed to rise to this occasion. Already rumpled in his summer formal, he made a few tasteless wisecracks as Mickey Isley and his magic music makers struck up the sultry sounds that had made them famous in every steel mill town that ringed Lake Michigan. Dark and sensuous, the dance floor engulfed us all. I felt tall and slim and beautiful, not realizing at the time that everybody feels that way wearing a white coat and rented pants. I could see myself standing on some mysterious balcony, a lonely, elegant figure, looking out over the lights of some exotic city, a scene of sophisticated gaiety behind me. There was a hushed moment when Mickey Isley stood in the baby spot, his wavy hair shining before a microphone shaped like a chromium bullet. "All right, boys and girls," the metallic ring of feedback framed his words in an echoing nimbus. "And now, something really romantic, a request. When the swallows come back to Capistrano, we're going to turn the lights down for this one." Oh, wow. The lights faded even lower. Only the Japanese lanterns glowed dimly, red, green, yellow, and blue, in the enchanted darkness. It was unquestionably the high point of my existence. Wanda and I began to maneuver around the floor. My sole experience in dancing had been gained from reading Arthur Murray ads and practicing with a pillow for a partner behind the locked door of the bathroom. As we shuffled across the floor, I could see the black footprints of the ad before my eyes, marching on a white page, 1, 2, 3, and then the white one that said, "Pause." Back and forth, up and down, we moved metronomically. My box step was so square that I went in little right angles for weeks afterward. The wool carnation rode high up on my lapel and was beginning to scratch my cheek, and an insistent itch began to nag at my right shoulder. There was some kind of wire or horsehair or something in the shoulder pad that was beginning to bore its way into my flesh. By now, my dashing concrete collar, far from having wilted, had set into the consistency of carborundum, and its incessant abrasive action had removed a wide strip of skin encircling my neck. As for my voice, due to the manic strangulation of the collar, it was now little more than a hoarse croak. "When the swallows return to Capistrano," mooed the drummer, who doubled as the band's romantic vocalist, I began to notice Wanda's orchid leering up at me from her shoulder. It was the most repulsive flower I'd ever seen. It was at least 14 inches across. It looked like some kind of overgrown Venus flytrap waiting for the right moment to strike. Deep purple with an obscene yellow tongue that stuck straight out of it and greenish knobs at the end. It clashed audibly with her turquoise dress. It looked like it was breathing. And it clung to her shoulder as if with claws. As I glided back and forth in my graceful box step, my left shoulder began to develop an itch that helped take my mind off the insane itch in my right shoulder, which was beginning to feel like an army of hungry soldier ants on the march. The contortions I made to relieve the agony were camouflaged nicely by a short sneezing fit brought on by the orchid, which was exhaling directly in my face. It had some breath. So was Wanda. Wanda had a heady essence of Smith Brothers cough drops and sauerkraut. When the deep purple falls over sleepy garden walls, warbled the vocalist out of tune into his microphone, which with he seemed to be dancing the tango. The loudspeakers rattled in three-quarter time as Wanda started to sweat through her taffeta. I felt it running down her back. She was sweating a river. My own back was already so wet you could read the label on my undershirt right through the dinner jacket. Back and forth we trudged doggedly across the crowded floor. Another Arthur Murray ad man, Schwartz, was doing exactly the same step with Clara May directly behind me. We were all in a four-part dog lockstep. As I hit the lower left-hand footprint in my square, the one marked pause, he was hitting the upper right-hand corner of his square. Each time we did that, our elbows dug smartly into each other's ribs. The jungle fragrance of the orchid was getting riper by the minute, and the sweat, which had now saturated my jockey shorts, was pouring down my legs in rivulets. My soaked cummerbund turned two shades darker so that she wouldn't notice. I pulled Wanda closer to me. Sighing, she hugged me back. Wanda was the vaguely chubby type of girl that was so popular at the time, like Judy Garland, by whom she was heavily influenced. She strongly resembled a kind of pink beach ball, but a kind of cute beach ball, soft and rubbery. I felt bumpy things under her taffeta gown with little hooks and knobs. Schwartz caught me a nasty shot in the rib cage just as I bent over to kiss her lightly on the bridge of her nose. It tasted salty. She looked up at me, her great liquid myopic eyes catching the reflection of the red and green lanterns overhead. During a brief intermission, Schwartz and I carried paper cups dripping syrupy punch back to the girls who had just spent some time in the ladies' room, struggling unsuccessfully to repair the damage to the first half. As we were sipping, a face from my dim past floated by from out of nowhere, haughty, alabaster, green-eyed, dangerous. "Hi, Daff," I muttered, spilling a little punch on my gleaming shoes, which had turned during the past hour into a pair of Iron Maidens. "Oh, Howard," she spoke in the breathy, sexy way that such girls always have at proms. "I'd like you to meet Budge Cameron. He's at Princeton." Oh, a languid figure, probably born in a summer formal, loomed overhead. "Budge, this is Howard." "Hiya, fella." It was the first time I'd heard the tight, nasal, swinging jaw accent of the true Princetonian. "Hi, Howard." This was not going to be the last. And they were gone. Funny, I couldn't even remember actually dating her, I reflected as the lights dimmed once again. Me and Wanda swung back into action. They opened into Sleepy Lagoon. 1, 2, 3, pause. 1, 2, 3, pause. It was certain now. I knew it. I had broken out in a raging rash. I felt it spreading like lava across my shoulder blades under the sweat. The horsehair, meanwhile, from the shoulder pad, had penetrated my chest cavity and was working its way toward a vital organ. Trying manfully to ignore it, I stared fixedly at the tiny turquoise ribbon that held Wanda's golden ponytail in place. With troubles of her own, she looked with an equally level gaze at my maroon wool carnation, which by this time had wilted into a clump of lint. All of a sudden it was over. The band played "Good Night, Sweetheart," and we were out into a driving rain. A driving rain. A violent cloudburst had begun just as we reached the door. My poor little car, the pride and joy of my life, was outside in the lot with the top down. None of us, of course, had an umbrella. We stood under the canopy as the roaring thunderstorm raged on. It wasn't going to stop. "You guys stay here. I'll get the car," I said finally. After all, I was in charge. It was my car. Plunging into the downpour, I sloshed through the puddles and finally reached the ford. She must have had at least a foot of water in her already, hair streaming down over my eyes, soaked to the skin and muddied to the knees. I bailed it out with a coffee can from the trunk, slid behind the wheel, and pressed the automatic top lever. Smooth as silk, it began to lift, and stuck halfway up. As the rain poured down in sheets and the lightning flashed, I pounded on the relays. Furiously, lightning flashed. I switched the lever off and on. More thunder. I could see the country club dimly through the downpour. Finally, The top groaned and flapped into place and made some bad sounds as it did so. I threw down the snaps, rolled up the windows, and turned on the ignition. The battery was dead. Oh, my God, the strain of hoisting that goddamn top had drained it dry. I yelled out the window at a passing car. It was Flick in his Chevy. Give me a push, Flick! The goddamn battery's dead! This had never, to my knowledge, happened to Fred Astaire. And if it rained on Gene Kelly, he just sang. Flick expertly swung his Chevy around and slammed into my trunk as I eased into gear. And when she started to roll, the Ford shuddered and caught. Oh, thank God. Flick backed up and was gone, hollering out the window, "See you at the rooster!" Wanda, Schwartz, and Clara May piled into the damp, soggy seats, and we took off. Do you know what happens to a maroon wool carnation on a white serge lapel in a heavy June downpour in the Midwest where it rains not water but carbolic acid from the steel mill fallout? Huh? Well, I had a dark, wide-spreading maroon stripe that went all the way down to the bottom of my white coat. My French cuffs were covered with grease from fighting the top, and I had cracked a thumbnail which was beginning to throb. Undaunted, we slogged intrepidly through the rain towards the Red Rooster. Wedged against my side, Wanda looked up at me, oblivious to the elements, with luminous love eyes. She was truly an incurable romantic. Schwartz wisecracked in the back seat, and Clara giggled from time to time. The savage tribal rite was nearing its final and most vicious phase. We arrived at the Red Rooster, already crowded with other candidates for adulthood. A giant red neon rooster with a blue neon tail flicked up and down in the rain set the tone for this glamorous establishment. An aura of undefined sin was always connected with the name Red Rooster. Sly winks, nudgings, and adolescent cacklings about what purportedly went on at the Rooster made it the in spot for such a momentous revel. Its waiters were rumored really to be secret henchmen of the mafia. But the only thing that we really knew for sure about the Rooster was that anybody on the far side of 7 years old could buy any known drink without question. This is what made it the real spot for us. The decor ran heavily to red-checkered oilcloth table covers, plastic violets, and the musical background was provided by a legendary jukebox that stood a full 7 feet high, featuring red and blue cascading waterfalls that gushed endlessly through its voluptuous facade. In full 200-watt operation, it could be felt, if not clearly heard, as far as Gary and as far south as Kankakee, a triumph of American aesthetics. Surging with anticipation, I guided Wanda through the uproarious throng of my peers. Schwartz and Clara May trail behind, exchanging ribald remarks with the gang. We occupied the only remaining table. Immediately, a beady-eyed waiter, hair glistening with Vaseline hair oil, sidled over and hovered like a vulture, quickly distributing the famous Red Rooster a la carte deluxe menu. He stood back, smirking, and waited for us to impress our dates. "Can I bring you anything to drink, gentlemen?" he said, heavily accenting the gentleman. My first impulse was to order my favorite drink of the period, a bottled concoction called K.O., the Wonder Drink. But remembering that better things were expected of me on this prom night, I said in my deepest voice, make mine, bourbon." Schwartz grunted in admiration. Wanda ogled me with great swimming, lovesick eyes. Bourbon was the only drink I'd actually heard of. My old man ordered it often down at the Bluebird. I had always wondered what it tasted like. I was soon to find out.
"How will you have it, sir?"
"Well, in a glass, I guess." I had failed to grasp the subtlety of his question, but the waiter snorted in appreciation of what he thought was my humorous sally.
"Rocks," he continued.
"Rocks? I had heard about getting your rocks, but never in a restaurant." "Oh, well, what the hell?" "Sure," I said. "Why not? Rocks." All around me, the merrymaking throng was swinging into high gear. Carried away by it all, I added a phrase that I heard my old man use often. "And, waiter, make it a triple." I had some vague idea that this was a brand or something.
A triple? Yes, sir, a triple.
His eyes snapped wide in respect, I gathered. He knew now that he was in the presence of a serious drinker. The waiter turned his gaze in Schwartz's direction.
And you, sir?
Make it the same. Schwartz had never been a leader. The die was cast. Pink Ladies, at the waiter's suggestion, was ordered for the girls, and we then proceeded to scan the immense menu with feigned disinterest. When the waiter returned with our drinks, I ordered, for reasons that even today I am not able to explain, lamb chops, yellow turnips, mashed potatoes, and gravy, a side dish of the famous Red Rooster Roquefort Italian coleslaw, and strawberry shortcake. The others wisely decided to stick with their drinks. Munching breadsticks, Wanda Schwartz, Claire, and I engaged in sophisticated post-prom repartee. Moment by moment, I felt my strength and maturity, my dashing bonhomie, my clean-cut handsomeness enveloping my friends in its benevolent warmth. Schwartz, too, seemed to scintillate as never before. Clara giggled, and Wanda sighed, overcome by the romance of it all. Even when Flick, seated three tables away, clipped Schwartz behind the left ear with a poppy seed roll, our urbanity remained unruffled. We ignored him totally. Before me reposed a sparkling tumbler of beautiful amber liquid. Ice cubes bobbed merrily on its surface. A plastic swizzle stick sporting an enormous red rooster sticking out at a jaunty angle. Schwartz was similarly equipped, and the fluffy pink ladies looked lovely in the reflected light of the pulsating jukebox. Now, I had seen my old man deal with just this sort of situation. Raising my beaded glass, I looked around at my companions and said suavely, "Well, here's mud in your eye." Clara giggled, sighed dreamily. Now totally in love with this man of the world, Wanda joined in. She sat just across from the table on this, our finest night. "Yep," Schwartz parried wittily, hoisting his glass high and slopping a little bourbon on his pants as he did so. Swiftly, I brought the bourbon to my lips, intending to down it in a single devil-may-care draft, the way Gary Cooper used to do it at the Silver Dollar Saloon. I did, and Schwartz followed suit. Down it went, a screaming 90-proof rocket searing savagely down my gullet. For an instant, I sat stunned, unable to comprehend what had happened. Eyes watering copiously, I had a brief urge to sneeze, but my throat seemed to be paralyzed. Wanda and Clara May swam before my misted vision, and Schwartz seemed to have disappeared under the table. He popped back up again, face beet red, eyes bugging, jaw slack, tongue lolling. "Oh, isn't this romantic? Isn't this the most wonderful night in all our lives? I will forever treasure the memories of this wonderful night." From far off, echoing as from some deep subterranean tunnel, I heard Wanda speaking these words. Deep down in the pit of my stomach, I felt crackling flames licking at my innards. I struggled to reply, to maintain my elan, my fabled savoir-faire. I couldn't talk. Something paralyzed. Yeah, I finally managed with superhuman effort. Wanda swam hazily into focus. She was gazing across the table at me with large, liquid, adoring eyes. "Another gentleman? Another?" The waiter was back, still smirking. Schwartz nodded dumbly. I just sat there, afraid to move. An instant later, two more triple bourbons materialized in front of us. They looked even bigger than the first. Clara raised her pink lady high and said reverently, "Let's all of us drink to the happiest night of our lives." There was no turning back. Another screamer rocketed down the hatch. For an instant, it seemed as though this one wasn't going to be as lethal as the one on the first shot, but the room suddenly tilted sideways. I felt torrents of sweat pouring down my forehead. Clinging to the edge of the table, I watched as Schwartz gagged across from me. Flick, I noticed, had just chug-a-lugged his third rum and coke and was eating a cheeseburger with the works. The conflagration deep inside me was now heavily out of control. Clearly, my feet were smoking. My diaphragm heaved convulsively, juggling my cummerbund, and Schwartz began to shrink, his face alternately between purple, red, and chalk white, his eyes black holes staring fixedly at the ketchup bottle. He seemed to be talking to it. He sat stock still. Wanda, meanwhile, cooed on ecstatically. But I was beyond understanding what she was saying. Faster and faster, in ever-widening circles, the room, this jukebox, the crowd, swirled dizzily about me. In all the excitement of preparation for the prom, I realized that I hadn't eaten a single thing all day. Out of the maelstrom, a plate mysteriously appeared before me. Paper-pattied lamb chops hissing in bubbling grease, piled yellow turnips, gray mashed potatoes, awash with thick brown gravy. Maybe this will help, I thought incoherently and stupidly. Maybe this will help me. Grasping my knife and fork firmly as I could, I paused and tried to whack off a piece of meat. Suddenly, the landscape tilted again, 45 degrees to starboard, and the chop I was about to attack skidded off my plate, plowing a swath through the mashed potatoes and right into the aisle. Pretending not to notice, I addressed myself to the remaining chop, which slid around, eluding my grasp, until I finally managed to skewer it with my fork. Hacking off a chunk, I jammed it fiercely mouthward, missing the target completely. Still impaled on my fork, the chop slithered over my cheekbone, spraying gravy as it went, all over my white lapels. On the next try, I had better luck, and I finally managed to get the whole chop down, probably the bone, too. To my surprise, I didn't feel any better. Maybe the turnips will help, I thought. Lowering my head to within an inch of the plate to prevent embarrassing mishaps, I shoveled them in. But the flames within me only seemed fanned by this stuff. Higher and higher they went. I tried the potatoes and gravy. My legs began to turn cold. They were made out of ice. I wolfed down the Red Rooster Roquefort Italian coleslaw. My stomach began to rise like a helium balloon, bobbing slowly up the alimentary canal. It was coming right up through my throat. My nose, now low over the heaping dish of strawberry shortcake piled high with whipped cream and running with juice. I knew at last for a dead certainty what I had to do before it happened right here in front of everybody. I struggled to my feet. A strange rubbery numbness had struck my extremities. I tottered from chair to chair, grasping for the wall. There was a buzzing in my ears. 20 seconds later, I was down on my knees, gripping the bowl of the John like a life preserver in pitching seas. Schwartz, imitating me as usual, lay prostrate on the tiles beside me, his body racked with heaving sobs. Lamb chops, bourbon, turnips, mashed potatoes, coleslaw, all of it came rushing out of my mouth, my nose, my ears, my very soul. Then Schwartz opened up, and we took turns, retching and shuddering. A head thrust itself between us, directly into the pot. It was Flick, moaning dejectedly, crying out wretchedly. Up came the cheeseburgers, the rum and cokes, the pretzels, the potato chips, punch, gumdrops, a corned beef sandwich, a fingernail or two, everything that he had eaten for the last month. For long minutes, the three of us lay there, limp and quivering, smelling to high heaven, too weak to get up. It was the absolute high point of the junior prom. The rest was anticlimax. Finally, we returned to the table, ashen-faced and shaking. Schwartz, his coat stained and rumpled, sat zombie-like across from me. The girls didn't say much. Pink ladies just aren't bourbon. But our little group played the scene out bravely to the end. My dinner jacket was now even more redolent and disreputable than when I'd first seen it in the hangar at Al's. It was worse than when I had first seen it. And my bow tie, which had hung for a while by one clip, somehow had disappeared down the John completely, perhaps flushed into eternity with all the rest. But as time wore on, my bearing, my hearing, my eyesight began slowly to return. My legs began to lose their rubberiness, and the room slowly resumed its even keel, at least even enough to consider getting up and leaving. The waiter seemed to know. He returned as if on cue, bearing a slip of paper. Ah, the damages, gentlemen, the damages. Taking the old man's 20 out of my wallet, I handed it to him with as much of a flourish as I could muster. There wouldn't have been any point to looking over the check. I wouldn't have been able to read it anyway. In one last attempt to recoup my cosmopolitan image, I said offhandedly, "Keep the change." Wanda beamed in unconcealed ecstasy. The drive home in the damp car was not quite the same as the one that had begun the evening so many weeks earlier. Our rapidly fermenting coats made the enclosed air rich and gamey, and Schwartz, who had stopped belching, sat with head pulled low between his shoulder blades, staring straight ahead fixedly. Women always survive. Only the girls preserve the joyousness of the occasion. In a daze, I dropped off Schwartz and Clara May and drove in silence towards Wanda's home, the faint light of dawn beginning to show in the east. We stood on her porch for the last ritual encounter. A chill dawn wind rustled the lilac bushes.
Oh, this was the most wonderful, wonderful night of my whole life. I always dreamed the palm would be like this, breathed Wanda, gazing passionately up into my watering eyes.
Yeah, me too,
was all I could manage. I knew what was expected of me now. Her eyes closed dreamily, swaying slightly. I leaned forward, and the faint odor of sauerkraut from her parted lips coiled slowly up my nostrils. This was not in the script. I knew I'd better get off that porch fast, or else. Backpedaling, desperately down the stairs, I blurted, "Bye, bye," and fighting down my rising gorge, clamped my mouth tight, leaped into the Ford, burned rubber, and tore off into the dawn. 2 blocks away, I squealed to a stop alongside a vacant lot containing only a huge Sherman Williams paint sign. "We cover the world," it aptly read. In the blessed darkness behind the sign, concealed from prying eyes, I completed the final rite of the ceremony. The sun was just rising as I swung the car up the driveway and eased myself quietly into the kitchen. The old man who was going fishing that morning with Zudok sat at the enamel table sipping black coffee. He looked up as I came in. He was in no mood for idle chatter. "You look like you had a hell of a prom, kid," was all he said. "I sure did." The yellow light glared harshly on my muddy pants, my maroon-streaked, vomit-stained white coat, my cracked fingernail, my greasy shirt. I'd lost a shoe somewhere. "You want anything to eat?" he said sardonically. "How about something to eat, kid?" At the word "eat," my stomach, heaved convulsively. I shook my head numbly. "That's what I thought," he said. "Well, get some sleep. You'll feel better in a couple of days when your head stops banging. I've been there, kid." He went back to reading his paper. I staggered into my bedroom, dropping bits of clothing as I went. My soggy Hollywood paisley cummerbund, the veteran of another gala night, was flung beneath the dresser as I toppled in the bed. My brother muttered in his sleep across the room. He was still a kid, but his time would come.